good morning. I was trying to think of a great way to start this morning, and I didn't think I could do better than the last two men who've preached from this pulpit. Pastor Park, remember his opening? Welcome to the best day of the week. And then, of course, can't do better than Pastor Heim. Let's talk about Jesus. And so that there's no better way to start it than welcome to the best day of the week, because we're going to talk about Jesus. So our slide, to begin with, Jesus is better than anything you think you must have. And actually, the title here, Jesus is Better, How to Sin Less and Love More. That sounds a bit like a get-rich-quick scheme, doesn't it? Well, where we want to head today is this foundational statement. Jesus is better than anything you think you must have. And so we're going to dive into Hebrews, and we're going to see how Jesus is better. But first, we got to think about this particular word, better. And to do so, we need to look at some words. Because, you know, there's some words in the English language that just get a bum rap, don't they? And when you hear them, you immediately think of the negative connotation. So I want to take a journey with you on a quick quiz. I'm going to show you two words, and without thinking about it, which word has the negative connotation? You ready? All right, here we go. Okay, they can be used interchangeably, right? Mature and elderly. Which one is the negative connotation? No one had to think about that, right? But they could both be used applying to the same person, but elderly every time. In fact, I tried to think of an instance, well, elderly is not a negative connotation necessarily, and I really couldn't. Mature, now that sounds good. There's wisdom and sage positioning there. Elderly, well, that's just old, right? So a negative connotation. It's unfair to that poor word elderly, but it is what it is. Next one, ready? Just think of it right off the top. Which one? Now those words could be used interchangeably to the same person doing the same things, right? Someone who hasn't mowed their lawn since Memorial Day. Could just be, well, he's laid back. I mean, it just, the lawn doesn't matter. He's a laid back dude. That lawn is waving in the wind like a wheat field. Or, well, he's just lazy. Like, he doesn't get out there and do his yard work. He's lazy. Both kind of the same word, but one has a negative connotation, doesn't it? All right, a couple more here. I think you're getting the hang of this. Driven versus pushy. Which one's negative? Pushy, right. When you think of driven, you think of that entrepreneur, that person who's got goals, they've got ideas, they've got momentum, they are moving towards something, they're driven. Well, if you're just pushy, well, that's something else. You need to just step back, right? Pushy's a negative connotation. Two words applied to the same person. One, well, not one that we really want applied toward us. All right, one more here. Curious versus nosy. Well, if someone's curious, they're just inquisitive. They want to know something so they can grow and learn, and how wonderful. If you're nosy, you're just sticking your nose where it shouldn't be. You don't need to know. That's not information for you. You're just nosy. Two words, same person. One's a bit negative. All right, now these two words don't necessarily mean the same thing. Which one's negative? Generally, people would say what? Comparing. That can have a negative connotation, right? If we're cooperating, we're working together. We're on the same team, right? Team, together, everyone achieves more. How wonderful. Well, if you're comparing, well, that's a bit more dangerous. Why? Why is comparing a bit negative in some circles? Yeah, winners. You come out with a winner, and if you have a winner, well, you're going to have a loser. And so comparing can be negative. The point of comparing really is to determine superiority. right? And that can be dangerous because we want to find out which one's the best. But comparison is actually necessary. Think about when you bought your home. Does anyone set out to buy a home that's not the best for them? I remember when I bought my first home, I was pre-approved for $100,000 back in 1998. I assumed I could buy any house in Chelsea for that. And so I remember calling my realtor and saying, I have set aside this entire day for you to show me all of the houses that I could buy in Chelsea at $100,000 or less. And so the big day came and the realtor pulled up in her car and I jumped in and I said, look, if there's too many today, we can go next week. And she said, well, I have three. This is back in 1998 still. And so I said, okay, well, let's see these three, thinking, okay, we're going to have to do this comparison. And so we drive by the first one and don't stop. And she just points at it and says, that's house number one. It's condemned. There's animals living in it right now. It's going to be torn down. I'm not going to show it to you. I refuse to. Okay, that's choice number one. Hopefully we go up from there. And we did, but only slightly. So then we drove about 10 miles outside of town, north of town, toward a lake community. I thought, all right, now we're cooking. Lake community, access to the lake. And she said, well, here we go. Now, this is actually a three-season cabin, not really insulated, and it'd have to be shut down in October. So I said, you mean like I couldn't live here year-round? No. And so that was house number two. Now my comparison is getting pretty narrow. So we drive the 447 Railroad Street over here. And she showed it to me, and it was a bachelor pad. It was from the 1800s. There was orange shag carpeting stained a multitude of colors. There was wood paneling that was decomposing because of ants. But compared to the other two, it was great. And so I bought 447 Railroad. So sometimes you have to compare in life. For example, also a job. You're searching for a job. You're going to compare the jobs, right? Salary, your boss, location. It's necessary for you to determine superiority when you're searching for a job. So there are times in life that you must compare to determine what's the best. Now, where does this get dangerous? With people. This is where it gets dangerous, because when I compare with people, as we talked about earlier, I can come out ahead if I want to, or I could come out behind, just depending on the person. If I'm going to compare myself as a father, I could look over there at Jimmy and say, well, Jimmy, he barely gets off the couch. He forgot his son's birthday. Hasn't played catch with him in 2 years. I'm feeling pretty good about my fathering. But then I look over here at Billy. And Billy, well, he's doing science experiments with his son every Sunday on the kitchen counter, and they're learning the Greek New Testament together with his five-year-old. I'm not feeling too good about my fathering at this point. And so I can come out behind or ahead depending on that. And that's where it gets dangerous. You see, when you compare, it can create a sense of dissatisfaction with where you're not, or dissension with somebody else. And you think, when you think of people, for example, how hard would it be to be Mark Nelson's younger brother going through school, right? You walk into a classroom, oh, you're Mark Nelson's younger brother? You're not quite as tall, dark, and handsome as I suspected based on your older brother. You must be great at math and English. Well, not really. Oh, that's surprising given Mark Nelson's acuity with all of this, right? And you would go through, and it'd be awfully hard to live up to Mark Nelson because I'm getting compared, and it's not fair. And that happens, correct? Yeah, okay. It's not fair comparing people generally. But of course, it's also necessary at times. Did you compare when you were courting and dating? I sure hope so. No one sets out to like, well, you know, time to get married. I'll just take whatever comes my way. No criteria or standards. Not really going to compare. I'm happy for whatever second, third, fourth, fifth best comes my way. No. When you were dating, about ready to get married, you were comparing because you wanted the best spouse in the world. And that required some thought, some comparing, some consideration to end up with who you got married to. You see, in order to determine the best, the superior thing, comparisons might actually be necessary. Now, why is this important to us? Why is superiority important to us as Christians? Is it? Actually, yes. Yes, it is. You see, recognition and pursuit of superior things is actually critical to living a life in Christ. So let's unpack that a little bit. What does it mean if something is superior? Well, it means it's the best in substance or nature. It's the top quality. It's the best you can get. Something that's superior produces the best results. You couldn't do better than with this particular thing. Something that's superior brings about the most satisfaction and joy possible. That's what superior things do. Now let's go look at some goofy real-life examples before we hop in. All right. Tanya and I are coffee, I was going to say snobs, connoisseurs sounds better, right? Okay. So we like the most expensive, highest quality, darkest roast of the coffee family. And you can imagine my dissatisfaction. Sayla and I got away to an Airbnb in New Buffalo. And we walked into this little Airbnb, and I was excited about the next day's coffee. But look what I saw when I walked in. Now, apologies if these are your favorite brands, but I have to tell you, these are not the superior brands. They're made with Robusto beans, which are inferior to Arabica beans. And so the next morning, I got up, and I didn't have a choice. I took the Folgers, and I unscrewed it. And the light roast sparkling in there got into the coffee maker. And I drank that coffee, and it was hot, and it was liquid, and it was brown, but that was about it. And so when I was done with that coffee, there was a real sense of dissatisfaction and yearning for something else. Yearning for like a Starbucks or a Big B. That didn't create this sense of joy in me. What about this one? If you're, let's say, a seafood fan, you go to a real seafood company in downtown Ann Arbor and you pay $28 for a plate of scallops or salmon, and it comes with hazelnut crusted almonds and whatever else, right? And it's drizzled with a caramel sauce imported from Italy. Oh, you want nothing else. Imagine, though, if you were served a plate of frozen fish sticks with ketchup to dip in it. How would you walk away feeling dissatisfied with that? Well, you see, one thing is superior, and it creates a satisfaction. One thing's not, and you leave feeling less than filled. Or how about this one? Lakes. Well, Kavanaugh Lake, right down the street, right down the road. A wonderful lake, right? Lots of water, but it's not the best. It's inferior to Lake Michigan. I think Lake Michigan is the best lake in the world. The dunes, the sunsets, it's a little slice of heaven on earth. Oh, I can go to Kavanaugh Lake and go kayaking and enjoy it, but I'm always wanting something more. I'm always wanting Lake Michigan. That's why we compare and pursue the superior, because we walk away feeling filled and wanting nothing else when we have the superior. In each case, I'm filled with that thing. Now, what does this have to do with Jesus? Well, now it's time, okay? All right, so if we go to the scriptures, the foundational statement we looked at earlier says, Jesus is better than anything I could want. Okay? Let me read this to you, and we're going to dive into Hebrews. So if you haven't gotten to Hebrews yet, get there, okay? Jesus is absolutely, unequivocally superior to everything else in your life. Until you know this and pursue him as your deepest source of joy, you're only skimming your faith. Now, you might be saying, of course, that's a no-brainer. But I like you don't do that in every circumstance. And it ends up to sin and loving him less. So let's get into Hebrews here. Just a quick context of what Hebrews is. We don't really know the author. Some people feel very strongly it's Paul. Some people feel very strongly it's not Paul. We really don't know who it is, so we're not going to spend any time on that. Suffice it to say, it's the Holy Spirit working through somebody. This was probably written around 67 AD, not that far from Jesus walking the earth, because the temple was still standing. And we think then that the Levitical priesthood of sacrifices was still in operation, which is important here. We'll find that out in just a little bit. So this was written to Hebrew Christians who were facing some sort of persecution, and even to some Jewish unbelievers who were steeped in some of their traditions. And so in all of those things, those pulled away from Jesus as the potential superior thing. And so whoever the author is, they're very interested in one thing. They're very interested in telling the readership that Jesus is better. In fact, in Hebrews, this word better is used 13 times over and over and over again, like a comparison. In fact, the Bible is very, very keen on comparing Jesus, wanting to compare two people or two things, so we can see, is Jesus really better? So go to Hebrews 3:1, and we'll see that Hebrews is all about comparing. The New King James in Hebrews 3:1 says this: "Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling," and then this is what it says, "consider the apostle and high priest of our confession, Christ Jesus." And the word "consider" there is to think or observe, learn about, to contemplate. It's like you're holding up a piece of glass or diamond, and you're holding it up to the light. Consider it. Look at it. Turn it around in your hands to see it fully. The Bible's not backing away from that dirty word "compare." The Bible's saying, let's hold Jesus up. Anything you want to throw up here on the counterbalance, go ahead. We're going to hold Jesus up. And you got to love the Message. Right, the Message Bible is not one you're going to use in seminary. Every once in a while it has a golden nugget. This is what the Message says in Hebrews 3:1. "So my dear Christian friends, companions in following this call to the heights, take a good hard look at Jesus." That's the Message. Same thing. Take a good hard look at Jesus. So that's what we're going to do here. All right. Now, Hebrews is a beautiful book. It's deep. It's wide. It's vast. We're going to go through a big chunk of it here, and unfortunately, we can't get too deep in any one regard, but we're going to go through a lot of verses to do this. Take a good, hard look at Jesus this morning. And what Hebrews wants to show is Jesus is superior. He's greater. He's better. He's above all. He's more valuable. That's what it's going to show. So let's start with this. It's going to compare... Whoa, hold on. We don't want to get there yet. There we go. Okay. It's going to compare a who's who list, a who's who, the best of the best, up against Jesus. Better than. Let's start with the prophets. Okay? So turn to Hebrews 1:1. The prophets. Oh, the prophets were good. They were really good. Hebrews 1:1 says, "God, who at various times and in various ways spoke in time past to the fathers by the prophets." Now just stop there for a minute. Did you catch what the prophets do or did or how they were used? They served a very distinct, narrow role, giving the declarations of God from God himself. That's incredible. That way to be used by God was absolutely distinct, specific, and such an honor. In fact, the Hebrew word for the prophet is nebi, which means bubble forth like a fountain. They spoke on God's behalf like a fountain bubbling forth his words. Holy cow. I might say, well, God told me to do this, but it wasn't actually because God verbally told me to do that. I'm hearing it from his word here. They had a whole different relationship with God. These guys, these prophets, incredible. pillars of the Old Testament. Yeah, the prophets were good, but you know what? Jesus is better. Let's take a look at this. Jesus is better. Look at 1, 2 through 3. There are seven things in those two verses that say, oh, the prophets, they were good. Jesus is better. Look at this. 2 through 3. Has in these last days spoken to us by his Son, whom he has appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the worlds, who being the brightness of his glory and the express image of his person and upholding all things by the word of his power, when he had by himself purged our sins, sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Okay, ready for this? Seven ways Jesus is better than the prophets. Here we go. This is all in 2 and 3. Jesus is appointed heir of everything. Well, the prophets can't say that. Jesus is the one through whom God made the universe. Pretty sure none of the prophets were there at the beginning commanding light to come forth from dark. Jesus radiates the glory of God. That doesn't mean he reflects it. That means he is it. He emanates it from himself. Jesus is the perfect likeness of God's being. He sustains the universe with his powerful word. Pretty sure that's not the prophet's role. Jesus made cleansing for our sin, and Jesus took the right hand seat of God. There's no prophet sitting there. Seven things all packed in there to say, oh, the prophets are good, but Jesus is better. All right, next, Moses. Oh, Moses was good. In fact, I should probably go farther. Moses was great. We really cannot overestimate how big Moses was to the Hebrew Christians. It would be like Abraham Lincoln for us, right? I mean, we revere that guy. Civil War, abolition, even the beard and the hat, right? I mean, there's something about Abraham Lincoln. No one speaks ill of Abraham Lincoln. It's the same thing with the Hebrews. When they look at Moses, oh, great. Most humble man on earth, chosen to lead the people out of captivity. Saw the backside of God. He was an Old Testament legend. Moses was great. But you know what? Jesus is better. Hebrews 3, 2 and 6. Now these are all just quick hitter verses, but they very quickly put to bed any thought in the Hebrew Christians' minds that could Moses possibly be better? Take a look. 3, 2 through 6. We started with one that said, hey, consider Jesus. Look at him. That's one. Two goes on to say, Jesus, who was faithful to him who appointed him, as Moses also was faithful in all his house. For this one has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses. Inasmuch as he who built the house has more honor than the house. For every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God. And Moses indeed was faithful in all his house as a servant for a testimony of those things which would be spoken afterward. But Christ as a son over his own house. We'll just stop there. So we look at this, and there's 100 reasons. Just this one. Moses was faithful in God's house. Jesus is faithful over God's house. You see the difference? One is over. He's the superior. Moses is a servant. Moses is a servant. What's Jesus? The Son. Is one superior? Without a doubt. Oh, Moses is great. But Jesus, he's better. He's better. How about Joshua? We're rolling through the who's who. How about Joshua? Oh, Joshua was good. He was really good. A man's man, commander, leader, courageous. How about this distinction? Leading the people into the promised land. I have a hard time even coming up with an equivalent nowadays. What would that even mean? To lead someone into this promised land that was thought about, written about, dreamed about for years and years and years and years. And you're the person who leads this mass of God's people into the land? What an honor. What a man, right? Well, Joshua's good. He's really good, but guess what? Jesus is better. And here's one of many reasons. Again, we're just skimming the surface, but it's giving you reasons. All you need is one reason. 4:1-8. Let's take a look at this. Joshua is good. How is Jesus better? It's the idea of rest. 4:1. Therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest. That's what the promised land was. They had been wandering aimless in the desert. They'd been in Egypt, longing for this land of rest. And they get there with Joshua. Okay? Let us fear lest any of you seem to have come short of it. For indeed, the gospel was preached to us as well as to them, but the word which they heard did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in those who heard it. For we who have believed do enter that rest, as he has said. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Although the works were finished from the foundation of the world, he has spoken in a certain place of the seventh day in this way. And God rested on the seventh day from all of his works. And again in this place, they shall not enter my rest. Since, therefore, it remains that someone must enter it, and those to whom it was first preached did not enter because of disobedience, again, he designates a certain day, saying in David, today, after such a long time, as it has been said, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, then he would not afterward have spoken of another day. So here's the deal. Finally, Joshua leads them into the promised land. They're finally there, all is well, except it's not really rest. It's temporary rest, because guess what? Their gardens still had weeds that grew out of it. They still had these big, hairy foreigners trying to come in to take them, and they had to fight them. That's not rest. It's temporary rest. Who provides, who is the only one who can provide eternal rest? Jesus. Jesus is the only one who can do that. Jesus is better than Joshua. How about Aaron? Aaron was good. Let's turn to 5:4. 5:4. Was Aaron good? Oh, yeah. And no man takes this honor to himself, being a priest. But he who is called by God, just as Aaron was. Aaron was called by God to his designation as priest. Incredible. There was no election. There was no consensus. God saw Aaron and chose him. This is an extreme honor. Look at verses 1-3 of 5. For every high priest taken from among them is appointed for men in things pertaining to God, that he may offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can have compassion on those who are ignorant and going astray, since he himself is also subject to weakness. Because of this, he is required, as for the people, so also for himself, to offer sacrifices for sins. That's the duty of a high priest. Huge honor, huge responsibility. That's Aaron, designated by God. In fact, one who had to be a priest had to be in the lineage of Levi, and even descended from Aaron. It's kind of like Tanya and I just finished The Crown on Netflix. Great, except for one particular episode. But it's always amazing to me that this person can be king or queen just based on their bloodline. And it all stems back to Queen Anne in 1714, who was the first matriarch, first monarch of England, Ireland, and Scotland. They all stem from her. Well, Aaron has that same designation. He's the patriarch here. So yeah, Aaron is good. He's really good, but guess what? Jesus is better. Take a look at Hebrews 7:22. Aaron was a great high priest. Incredible high priest. Jesus comes along, and there's no comparison. 7:22. By so much more, Jesus has become a surety of a better covenant, a guarantee of a better covenant. Jesus comes along, and it's already better. See, he wasn't a Levite or Aaronite. He was designated by God as the new superior high priest of a brand new covenant. And he wasn't constrained by death. All the other priests had this thing called death that kind of ended their role. You see that in 23, 24, 25. There were many priests, but because they were prevented by death from continuing, but he, Jesus, because he continues forever, has an unchangeable priesthood. Yeah, Jesus. He's better than Aaron. All right, how about angels? Flipping gears a little bit. We're moving from people to angels. Well, angels are good. They're really good. They're this army of ministering spirits, glorious and majestic. We think about Gabriel, the messenger of God, standing in God's presence, made a man mute. Or Michael, the archangel, the chief prince. In Revelations, he fights this dragon. That's a glorious being right there. These angels were incredible beings. But guess what? Jesus is better than angels. If we look at one, let's flip back to Hebrews 1, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It's a quick hitter. Hebrews very quickly puts to bed, could the angels be better than Jesus? Now take a look. 1, 5. Which of the angels did he ever say, you're my son? None. Jesus is better right there, but it keeps going. 1, 6 through 7. When he again brings the firstborn into the world, he says, let all the angels of God worship him. Jesus is the firstborn worthy of worship, not angels. The angels say, don't worship me. Don't worship me. In 1:8, he's God enthroned. To the Son, he says, your throne is forever and ever. That's Jesus on the throne, not the angels. In 1:10, he's the eternal creator. In 1:13 and 14, he's the king. None of those apply to the angels. Angels are good. Jesus is better. All right, last one here. Jesus is better than a system, whatever that system is. We're going to look at one system here. That's the Levitical system of sacrifice. The old system was good. It was good. The high priest interceding on behalf of the people to cover their sins with sacrifices of blood. And if you look at Hebrews 9, 1 through 7, it goes through and describes this system, how the priests had to perform their duties to cover the sins of people. And it was a good system. But there's a better one. Jesus and the new covenant. I like Lightfoot, the commentator, says this. No heap of sacrifices or legal ordinance could make the guilty conscience clean or bring the worshiper nearer to God. The whole ancient system was at fault. What a futile system it was that could deal only with food and drink and absolutions. So if you look at Hebrews 9, 9 through 14, we see that. It was symbolic for the present time in which both gifts and sacrifices are offered, which can't make him who performed the service perfect. We can do all these things in the system, but it doesn't make us perfect. This is in regard to the conscience. We're concerned only with foods and drinks, various washings, fleshly ordinances imposed until the time of Reformation. All of this old system just covers the outside. And then look at the beauty of verse 11. But Christ came as high priest of the good things to come with the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands. That is not of this creation. Not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood. Better. It's better. He entered the most holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling an unclean, parentheses, are good, sacrifices for the purifying of the flesh, how much more, better, the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God. Pastor Jeff read this one last week or 2 weeks ago. 10:14. All of that results in Hebrews 10:14. By one offering, the superior priest, Jesus, one offering, he has perfected forever those who are being sanctified. Doesn't need to go back and re-sacrifice. His one sacrifice is superior to that old system. Okay, now if you're like me, you're saying, this is the best sermon I've ever heard. Because I got this. I do not struggle with Moses being better than Jesus. I mean, Moses is good. Don't get me wrong. He's great. Love those pictures in the children's stories of him. Love that. But I don't struggle with him being better than Jesus. Joshua, the angels, good, good, good. I got it. They're not better than, I don't struggle with that. Do you struggle with wanting the old covenant? Hey, you know what? I could raise a few unblemished lamb in my backyard, go out there with a knife. I think that would be better than the... Nobody says that. We all are on board with this. But you're missing the point of Hebrews if you say, I got it, Jesus is better than Moses and sacrifices. Period. Because they're saying, Jesus is better than everything, including what happens in 2021. Do you see Jesus as superior to everything in your world right now? You see, Christians don't plan to sin, do we? Oh, we sin, but it's not as if we schedule it. Like we sit down, Tanya and I do calendar planning on Sunday nights, and we look at the whole week. Monday, here's what has to happen. Tuesday, here's what has to happen. No Christian sits down and says, okay, let's see, it's Sunday night. You know what, Wednesday, let's schedule a sin. 5:45, I'm going to meet Gertrude, and we are going to gossip about Tanya behind her back. We're going to shred her. Her mothering, how she married Lumen is beyond us. Let's give 45 minutes of some good backbiting gossiping, and we'll stop there, praise Jesus. We got that on the calendar. That's not really what we do. So why do we sin? We say it happens in the moment. Instead, in particular moments, we lose sight of the fact that Jesus is better. And we let something else take over. I've heard someone say, sinning for a Christian is a moment of insanity. Jesus is better and you chose something else? Insane. But that's what happens. When you sin, Jesus quickly slides out. And just for a moment. And it feels good for a moment. And then we put Jesus right back up there. That's what happens. We don't plan for it. Well, all right, I'm going to go transparent here, okay? Let's show you my sin. Is Jesus better than ice cream? This is 2021. We're not talking angels and Moses. When I took Selah out to New Buffalo, we went to an ice cream place literally called Oinks. Oinks, like a pig. And Selah got a small sherbet, raspberry sherbet, 50 calories maybe. No, me, Ashby's ice cream, 50 flavors. I went with the biggest possible you could get, triple scoop with a chocolate-coated waffle cone. The only reason I didn't get a quadruple scoop, they don't make them. Because if they did, the fourth scoop would literally fall off. I had to lick like at 50 RPMs just to make sure that the top one wouldn't fall off. Now, what does this have to do with sin? Ice cream's good, but I can, in full honesty, let ice cream become better than Jesus. I might seek my pleasure or my satisfaction in that ice cream, even to the point of gluttony. There, I said it. Yes, this is the 2021 version of Moses for me. How about you? Well, for me, another one, and these are all good. These are all good. A bank book, IRA account. Oh, I love it when it comes in the mail and you open it up. Oh, and it just grew. Yes, this is great. It went down during COVID and it came back up. There's a sense of satisfaction. I see that IRA account go up. Oh, yeah, that's good. Do I ever get to the point where I find more satisfaction in that bank account than Jesus? Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Just for a moment. But that's where I sin, where I put my joy more in those riches than in Jesus. There's nothing wrong with ice cream and a healthy bank account. They're good. They are good. But do I let them replace Jesus? When I sin, I do. How about you? How about you? Let me read off a few things. Maybe one of these hits its mark. All of us have something that we temporarily replace and put ahead of Jesus. How about this? Political parties. Republican or Democrat, do you ever see that as higher than Jesus? Your children. Your spouse. Your job. You spend so much time at your job. Do you ever elevate that for satisfaction and joy above Jesus? America. What if you had to live in another country? I've asked myself that. We've lived in Asia before. Traveled all over. Been to 5 continents. What if you had to leave America forever? Would that crumble your world? Or is Jesus better? How about food, exercise, Netflix, a busy schedule? All of those things we can quickly make into an idol and replace Jesus with. sinning less, listen to this. This is where we're going with this. If I see Jesus as better than all of those things I just mentioned, that he's superior to anyone and everything, I will sin less and love him more. Because see, when I sin, my sin is the root of that is dabbling with sin. In the moment, I compare Jesus and a triple dip ice cream, maybe quadruple dip. And in that moment, I say, this ice cream's better. And I would go to the point of gluttony, to sin, to try to find that pleasure in the moment. And we all do that with certain things. How about love? How do we love him more, or how does seeing Jesus as better create this love? Well, the more I get to know him, the more I see that he's superior and better, 100% guaranteed. It's not like someone giving you a vacation recommendation. Like, I think you're really going to like Dexter, Michigan. There's a Dairy Queen. I don't know what else is there you would do. Oh, some trails. And so you travel from Iowa to go to Dexter, Michigan, and you get there and you say, this isn't exactly what I thought. Jesus is not like that. 100% guarantee, the more you get to know him, the more you see necessarily he is better and superior. The more I see and feel his superiority, the more glory I give him, and the more I love him, the more I love that he is superior, the less inclined I am to sin. Why would I choose second best? Why would I choose the home that's condemned with animals living in it? Jesus is superior. That's what I want. Of course, we're not going to get there 100% of the time, but the more we see Jesus as better, the more we love him, the less we sin. Now, where are you? Do you really grasp that Jesus is better? I mean, we say that academically. We say that on paper. Do we live that way with our hearts? I'm going to end with this song. Most of you have probably heard it before. You are better than all these things. And I want you to listen. He goes through, like Hebrews, and throws out things that are more 2021. Things like mountains made of gold, riches, IRA accounts. Jesus is better? You're better. Power to shake the moon. Jesus is better. Being liked and loved by everyone. Jesus is better. While the song is playing, the words are going to be up on the screen. I want you to look at the words, prayerfully consider, where do you supplant Jesus? Because just for that one insane moment, you think that thing is going to bring you greater pleasure. Jesus is better. All right, we'll play that, and then I'll close us out.